All right, go.
All right. Okay. So, okay. So, again, when you keep the Torah, now, Charlie's question is like this. When you help another person, all right, when you help another person, you're doing a good deed. But that good deed, that helping of another person, the greatest thing is for you yourself. You know why? And because for a moment you've removed yourself from your self-indulgence, which doesn't lead a person to happiness, only leads a person to misery, all right? That's the fooler. People think that they're indulging themselves. They're not indulging. They're indulging in themselves, and that's why they're miserable. The Torah is a different concept. The Torah says, if you could raise yourself for a moment out of those emotions, and you can perceive life on a higher level, and you can perceive the wisdom of God and His wisdom in creating man, and you look at another human being as a creature that was created by God, and you recognize the value of a human being, and then you recognize that he has a place in the universe just like you do, and then you help that being, then you're helping yourself because you've raised yourself to a higher level, a higher form of existence, and your satisfactions of our greater nature. So the one you've helped is really yourself, okay? But we say that the ultimate good is the study and the knowledge of Torah. And I explained that one time, that you cannot just say that helping another person is the Christianity tries to say that, but it doesn't work logically. Because if I'm helping him, so then what's his good? So his good is help somebody else, and helping, and it goes on ad infinitum. It's senseless. The helping another person is not the good. It is a part of the picture of the good. The ultimate picture of the good is the essence of the good is the study of Torah. That is the good, all right? But in order to study Torah, in order to recognize that good, part of recognizing that good it involves the love of God. When a person studies Torah, so then he becomes involved in the love of the Creator, and when he has a love for the Creator, he has to love God's creation. And he loves God's creation, he becomes a benefactor, all right? That's in that sense we say he imitates God, just like God benefits. So man also, when he reaches a truly higher level, so then he enjoys being a benefactor. Okay, that's a part of the picture. But the essence of the picture is the Shema, the love of God, which involves the constant preoccupation in Torah. That's what it says in the Shema, as I mentioned before. First, it says you should love the Lord your God, and then it tells you exactly how to do it. These words should be on your heart when you get up, when you go to sleep, constantly in the back of your mind. You're thinking about about being involved in Torah. By the way, there is a halachic, and I always like to bring halachic sources. You know, people read a lot of Midrash, don't know what they're reading, because the Midrash is a parable, and you have to know how to interpret it. But the halacha is clear and straightforward. That there's no question about what it means. Okay, and the halacha states, you know, there's a blessing that you make in the morning before you study Torah. Now that blessing goes for the entire day, and you know, in general, there cannot be. Between a blessing and an activity, there cannot be any space. In other words, if I make a blessing on a fruit, so I can't put the fruit down and come back a half hour later and eat the fruit. Because I must immediately, there must be a close proximity of time between the blessing and between the object. Whether it's a mitzvah, or let's say I make a blessing on the talit, on my, you know, the prayer shawl. So I can't make a blessing on the prayer shawl, go into the other room, read a book, and come back and put on it all. That would be worthless. I must put it on right away. Now, the question that the question has raised is, how come I make a blessing on studying Torah in the morning, and in the afternoon, if I want to say I come back from work 5 o'clock and I want to study Torah, I don't make another blessing. I rely on the blessing in the morning. But there was this whole span of time in between where I did all these other things. So how could that be? So the answer is, because a really righteous person, when he goes to work, he's preoccupied really with Torah. He thinks, see, the mitzvah of Torah is not an activity. It's more than an activity. It's a preoccupation. It's being involved. That's the commandment. To be involved in it. This should be on your heart. It means important to you. I can't wait to get to Torah. So really, when a person is working, a person who loves Torah, even when he's working in the back of his mind, he's waiting, hey, when am I going to finish so I can sit down and study some Torah, you see? So there never is a space, because he's always preoccupied in the back of his mind with Torah. And that's why the blessing is really on this whole state of mind in relationship to Torah. And that state of mind should be with a person no matter what he's doing. That's what the Bible says. When you're walking, when you're going, when you're sitting in your house, getting up, going to sleep, it should always be in the back of your mind. This should be what you're really interested in. Okay, this should be your primary interest. Enjoying the beauty of God's knowledge, studying Torah. That is where it's at. Now, let's go back to the world, okay? Now, the way we understand the world, kind of the way Torah understands it, and I told you that it's a very difficult idea, and that's why the Torah does not state it openly, because it would be completely misconstrued, all right? But the idea is that in the afterlife, once we lose the physical body that we have, then the soul is freed from the body. It does not have the limitations of the body anymore. And it exists in a totally free way, which means that the soul can function after death to the greatest, uninhibited by the body, and it functions to the degree. Okay? Now, a person that enjoys Torah in this world, could you imagine how much they will enjoy it in the next world? Infinitely more, because they won't have the limitations of the physical that we have here. All right? So any person that has an enjoyment always looks forward to a time when this enjoyment can be augmented, enhanced. All right? So therefore, that's what Maimonides means when he says that the great scholars looked forward to the world to come. What this means is they didn't look forward to the world to come as an exchange. God gave me the Torah. I was a good boy. Now give me something better. No, that would be derogatory. That would be degrading. But the way they look forward is that they say, God gave us such a wonderful life here with the Torah. Now we're going to be able to be involved in a limitless way with the Torah. This is something to look forward to. This is the great reward. This is an enjoyment which is beyond any enjoyment that a person can perceive of in this world, because all our physical pleasures are limited, extremely limited. And every pleasure, by the way, whether you're aware of it or not, but every passionate pleasure really has to carry with it pain. That's a necessity. People many times don't realize what they're doing. They think they're having pleasure, but really, if they thought about it, they see they're having pain. For instance, if a person eats. Now, when a person is hungry, he enjoys food. But if he keeps on eating as soon as the hunger stops, then the pleasure stops. And if he goes beyond that, he's just going to be in pain. So the pleasure of the eating is only there as long as you have the pain of the hunger. If you did not have pain, the true enjoyment of food is only if a person really is hungry. So he must have the desire for food in order to have the food. Now, a desire is always a pain. If a person is in a state of desire, he's in a state of pain. And that is the same thing is true with the enjoyment of love. The person, the love, you can only enjoy love if you have a tremendous desire involved. Now, as long as you have desire is a state of pain. So the satisfaction is only there as long as you have the desire. And as soon as you satisfy the desire, that's it. There's no more. The desire is gone. The satisfaction is gone. So all our pleasures in this existence are always tied to pain. Without pain, there is no pleasure. Pain and pleasure are very closely related. Socrates noticed this thousands of years ago, and psychoanalysts have taken up on this in a different approach, and they've shown that's true also. But it's true psychologically and it's true philosophically. So what Maimonides is explaining is that the physical pleasures are not really what people think they are. They always involve pain. But there is one pleasure that we can have in this existence, which is the purest, and that is the appreciation of the beauty of Torah. That's something we can have here. And anyone that has it here thanks God and is fortunate for having that ability, and he looks forward with even greater joy to the afterlife, where he can engage in knowledge of God in a limitless way. All right? You see, everything that we have in this world, we're very limited by the physical. For instance, our knowledge comes through our senses. Without the senses, without people, as you know, are unfortunate, who are missing the senses, have difficulty not only in a physical way, but in an intellectual way as well, because they're limited. So in this existence, the soul is limited by the physical, tied to the physical in a strange way that God in his infinite wisdom saw fit to do. Okay? We still don't understand how it works. But we know one thing, that there is this connection between the part of us that perceives the eternal and the part of us that's limited by the physical. So that's why Maimonides is not in contradiction, you see. When he says that the great, that the righteous people and the great people look forward to the world to come, the afterlife is really everything, because that's really, and if you, anyone that read through any of the Talmud knows that the Talmud states the afterlife, it says today, it's like a prepper, we're in a preparatory phase, okay? And the ultimate good is really the afterlife. That's because that we only have a part of it over here, and over there it expands into something completely that would seem to us completely unreal. In other words, it's augmented and enhanced in ways that we don't even comprehend. The kind of experience that we have, the kind of intellectual experience that we have after death and the afterlife is completely different, and it's, the enjoyment is greater, and it's a completely different kind of thing, but it's an expansion of the good, okay? But even if a person, but the Torah doesn't want to sell an afterlife, because then people would get the right, they'd say, I'm going to do God's commandments, so I get paid in the afterlife, which means I'm doing something painful to get paid for something that's really good. So there's something better than Torah. That is a fool, and that is why the Torah always says, do the Torah because it is good for you here. A person should do that which is good for him right now. The most an intelligent person is concerned, first of all, with the most immediate. That should be a person's first concern. Any person that's intelligent, the first is, well, let's see what's happening today and tomorrow. I mean, that's the most important thing. So there the Torah steps right in and tells us, this is the good. If you follow the way of Torah, you can have the best possible life right here. This is the way to live. This is the way to enjoy life. You want to have a great life? Keep the Torah. The Torah will give you the most enjoyable life possible. But when a person realizes what that good is, and that good stems from God's knowledge, then a person comes to the realization that in a desire to expand this experience, that experience can only be expanded upon in the afterlife. And that's where it finds its full existence. Its potential is fully realized in the afterlife. So now the question is, okay, so why do I do it? Do I do it for here or for there? What's the answer? The answer is for both, because it is the best way to live here, number one, and two, it's something which puts us on the route where in the afterlife we'll be able to experience far greater experience than we have over here. Okay? That is the answer. And that's why the rabbis say that it says, Ashrecha v'tovlach. And Ashrecha means you are very fortunate and it is good for you. This is so the rabbis explain the expression, what the expression means, the expression found in the prophets. It means you are fortunate in this world and it's good for you in the next world, which means both, okay? So that is the answer to the question. But the Torah only mentions here. It does not mention the hereafter because people never get that idea straight. In order for the Torah to mention the hereafter, the Torah would have to write a whole philosophy of what it means by hereafter. That's not the style of the Torah. The written law does not expand on philosophical principles. The written law has allusions to philosophical principles, but the oral law is where the real philosophy and the halacha and the science of Torah is in the oral, not in the written. The written is written on in a way that a simple person can read it and get the basic idea, enough to know that you have to pursue this a little further. Okay, but the Torah is not a book for abstract philosophy. This requires a lot of work. So that's why the Torah just gives the immediate. Says, do it right now. This is good for you right here. And the Torah also states that the people of Israel, if they keep the law, then the divine providence will play a role and will give them all the things that they need in order to exist, the good. And that's what I'm going to discuss at this point, okay? All right, if there's any question, David, I think wanted to jump in over here, or somebody else?
Well, I've been waiting for you to stop.
Okay, there I go.
All right, I've got two things, a question.
I just wonder, did I answer Charlie's question? because that's important. I'm trying to
Yeah, yes, you did.
Okay.
Here, he said, did a good job. Here's, I would summarize your statement this way. The reason the Torah does not spend a lot of time dealing with the afterlife is because the instinctual man, the appeal to him is to the afterlife.
Exactly.
All right, so therefore the Torah teaches us how to conquer the instinctual man in this life.
Beautiful. I couldn't have put it better myself. And so, again with the Egypt, you have to realize where people came from Egypt. What was Egypt? Egypt was doing everything over here in order for what? In order to have the real instinctual over there. They killed the slaves and they took their things with them in the tombs. That was the instinctual life par excellence, and they perceived the afterlife as, hey, now we're really going to have the instinctual enjoyment. Torah avoided that, took them out of Egypt and away from that whole kind of philosophy. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, the Torah deals with to subjugate the instinctual man in this world so that the spiritual man can sail in the world to come.
Exactly.
Okay, this is two questions, but it's two aspects of the same question. Number one, if the afterlife is concerning the soul only, then how does God... I got to put my glasses on because I can't read it. All right, if the afterlife is concerning with the soul only, then how does God destroy that which he created, in other words, the evil? That's Isaiah 45:7. Second aspect of the same question, do you carry the Torah knowledge gained in this world to the world to come?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Okay.
So those are two aspects of the same question.
Do you carry the Torah knowledge gained in this world in the world to come? That's question one. The second question was God destroying evil, which is the Isaiah 45.
That's correct. Does God destroy, if the afterlife is concerning the soul only, then... does God destroy the evil which he created?
Okay. All right. Now, let me take the second question first. Second question is really, is the Torah, do you take the Torah with you? This I could tell you from the rabbis and the scholars of the Talmud. They always speak about the fact that a person is fortunate who comes into the next world with his Torah. But they also mention that in the afterlife, a person has a greater opportunity. And if a person had a desire to study Torah, and he was unable to study in this world, that this alone, God accommodates him and permits him and gives him the opportunity to study over there too. Okay, so it's not just again. We always look for these simple solutions. It is not that simple, and we're talking about God and how God works. So, you know, what the prophet says, our thoughts are not his thoughts. So we have to know that we're just like, in a general way, we understand it, but we don't know all the particulars. But this much we say, that a person who has knowledge here of Torah, he takes that knowledge with him, and the knowledge over there is increased, and he sees it in a deeper, far deeper way, and it is tied into a knowledge of the Creator himself, okay? And also, a person that didn't have the opportunity to study Torah but had a desire to study Torah will have that desire fulfilled in the next world. God gives him the opportunity to study Torah there. Now, of course, you can ask me who's better and who's this. I'm not going to get into that. Okay, those kind of questions God will answer. But those are like curiosity questions. And as I said before, scholars try to stick to what they know. We don't know. We're only human beings, and we're fortunate that God gave us the amount of insight into these things that he did. And beyond that, you know, we have curiosity. It's very nice, but it's something that has to be, has to be controlled sometimes. Now, the other question, was about God creating evil. I want to set that one straight. That, I think, is a mistake that people make. And I think especially Christianity has made that mistake. God does not create evil. That is an impossibility. God does not create. Again, God does not create evil. The question you asked me is the verse in 45, Isaiah 45, where it says openly, all right, it says he creates the light, and he forms the light and creates darkness, all right? He does peace and creates evil. All right? And he says, I, God, do all these things. All right? Now, the problem is, of course, when a person takes a verse out of context, and the Torah is a very deep thing, and people have a lot of crazy notions. And what happens is a person has a notion, and he sees a verse, and he thinks, ah, that verse is saying exactly what I'm thinking. That must be it, you see? Not so quickly. You have to analyze the words of the prophets. The prophets were men of great, great genius. And when they write something, there's a deep idea here. You can't just take it as it appears on the surface, even though it may be in line with a person's simplistic kind of notions. You see, those simplistic notions are usually 99% of the time, they're completely off. All right? Now, if you take a look at Isaiah 45, you'll see, read the few verses before, all right, and you'll see what Isaiah is trying to say. He says, and take verse 5, for instance, I am God, and there is none other besides me. Besides me, there is no God. Okay? Then verse 6. In order they shall know that from the sun from the rising of the sun, that there is Ephes. There is nothing, zero, besides me. I am God, and there is no other. All right? That's verse 6. Now verse 7. He forms the light and creates darkness. He does peace and creates evil. I, God, do all these things. You understand what the prophet is trying to tell people? You see, the prophet is speaking out against the pagan belief. The pagan belief is that there are two forces in the universe, a good force and a bad force. Okay? Dualism, it was called. All right? Now, this idea that there are bad forces is, Isaiah is saying, is a denial of God. Because there is nothing, and that's why he reiterates in these previous verses, there's nothing besides God. Okay? That's what he's saying. God says, there is nothing besides me. Okay? What Isaiah is trying to show people is that evil, people think that evil is something other. There are two forces. There's a good force and an evil force. So Isaiah says, you're making a mistake. Everything comes from God. Now, what does that mean? What it means is like this. See, man has free will. In order for a man to have free will, he has to be able to choose a life that is good, and if he distorts his life, it's evil. Who creates evil if man has free will? Who creates evil? Man or God? The answer, obviously, is man. But now, if I ask you, does that mean that evil is a force in the universe, another force, like a devil or something else? No. It was made. Did God create it? In a sense, yes, because there's only one creator, and all creation came from God. So when God created man, and man has free will, so in one sense, I could say that, well, it all came from God. But God never created evil. God created man with free choice. Man, since he has free choice, and God's wisdom is that man should exist with this free choice, so man has the potential for evil. But when man does evil, it's not an outside force, another force besides God that he's involving himself with. That's what Isaiah is trying to tell the people. Because the ancients and the primitive people, and there's a carryover into the New Testament as well, with the devil as an alien force, an evil, a Satan, an evil. Okay? That is a denial of God. Because the moment you say there's another force besides God, that is already a denial of God. And that is what Isaiah is trying to tell people. He's saying there is nothing besides me, and if there's evil in the world, it's not from another source. I am the ultimate source of everything. You see, I, God, do all this, which means everything that exists only exists because of me. But that doesn't mean that God directly creates evil. That does not mean that. Heaven forbid. God doesn't create evil. But God's wisdom is that man should have free choice. If man has free choice, then he could do the wrong choice, and when he does the wrong choice, he creates evil. But is that another force? No, that all stems from God. There is nothing besides God. There is no dualism. There is no other force. That's what Isaiah is trying to point out. Okay? Now, the idea of evil being abolished in the world to come, okay, which is or in the afterlife, is very simple, because the concept of evil in the Torah is, as the rabbis say, There are three terms. The one term is called the angel of death, all right? The other term is called the evil inclination. And the other term is called Satan, okay? Now, the rabbis make a point of mentioning in several places that these three are one and the same thing. Satan, the evil inclination, and the angel of death are all the same, all right? Now, what does it mean? It means to say that all these things stem from the physical aspect of man, all right? The evil inclination, instinctual, as David mentioned, that's evil inclination. Now, the angel of death is the fact that since man is a physical, biological object, so he can't exist forever. He has to die. That's the angel of death. That's why it's also part of the fact, the element of the physical. And Satan, what is meant by Satan, is external circumstances that are untoward, that man. See, the word Satan in Hebrew always means an antagonist. For instance, it says by King Solomon that God set up a Satan for him. What was a Satan? Another king that was always bothering him. That's what the word says. It's not a mystical meaning. I mean, Christians came along and gave it a mystical meaning. It's not a mystical meaning. It means something which is a disturbance, an outside nuisance. Okay? Now, sometimes in man, sometimes the nuisance is an outside thing that he can't control, but sometimes that outside thing that he can't control is inside him. When a person has an emotion that he cannot control, it's referred to as a Satan. Why? Because it means it's like a nuisance, but the nuisance is a part of him. He has an unruly kind of emotion. Something in common expression, something's bugging him. You see, he doesn't know what it is. It's bothering him. That's what is meant by Satan.
Rabbi, so, you got yeah. about 2 minutes.
2 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. So. Thank you. So what is meant by the fact that the evil will cease does not exist in the afterlife, it means that in the afterlife, once the soul exists in its pure state, then the physical part is not related to him anymore, and that's why there is a cessation of the evil, okay? But this is not, you understand what I'm saying? In other words, and the same thing when we say that in the world to come, which is on this earth, so there again we say that man, the Bible says in Deuteronomy, that God will circumcise your heart. What is the circumcision of the heart? It means that the heart will be more sensitive to the wisdom of the person, the knowledge of Torah that they have, and there won't be that struggle. We experience a struggle. Even though we recognize the truth, we still have to struggle to get ourselves to learn. That struggle will be lightened, and the heart, the emotions, will naturally follow what the person's mind tells him is the good through his knowledge of Torah. So there again, we say that means that evil, then the person, when a person knows what the good is, a person would never choose evil if they really understand the good and if their emotions can go along with the good. So that's what is meant that in the world to come, which is on this planet, the evil will cease to exist. That means man will have knowledge, and his emotions will follow that knowledge. Okay, we're here.